We are talking once again with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
All right. Lots to cover, so let's just dive right in and start with the family of Manuel Ellis appears to be suing the Tacoma Police Department.
And Pierce County. Manuel Ellis, is for people who don't remember, was killed by Tacoma police in March of 2020 under very dubious circumstances. He was basically detained while he was walking home and choked to death. And,
people might remember some of the video about it. It showed a man laying on the ground who was hogtied with a hood over his head. Officers stopped him. They beat him. They tased him, choked him, took him to the ground, hogtied him. And when he was protesting that he couldn't breathe, they put a hood over his head.
Yeah.
That's how most people remember the shocking death of Manuel Ellis.
And, you know, once the protests over George Floyd erupted a couple months later, people were going, wait a minute, what about this incident in Tacoma, and why hasn't there been an investigation of it? The so-called internal investigation dragged on for months and months, and then finally, Tacoma outsourced it to the Washington State Patrol, and I think
they outsourced it to the Pierce County Sheriff's Department, and the Pierce County Sheriff's Department drug their feet, and the Pierce County Sheriff, Ed Troyer, made some inaccurate statements that were directly proved wrong by the video that came out. There were several witnesses on the scene, two of whom videoed the interaction with the police on their cell phones, and at least six witnesses testified later that Manuel Ellis was not doing anything wrong when police stopped him.
Yeah, and Troyer, of course, ran into his own problems with a racist incident this past winter, and he inexplicably is still on the job. But the investigation was then outsourced, I think, last spring to the Washington State Patrol, and we've heard nothing since. There is still no outcome, at least no public outcome, to the investigation, even though, as Maria said, there's, you know, several videos of the incident, which appear to show, you know, basically that he was murdered. So, yesterday, the family of Manuel Ellis sued the Tacoma Police Department, as well as Pierce County, it's a civil rights lawsuit for wrongful death. And, you know, we'll see what comes of it. The discovery and that the civil suit would be very interesting to see when it happens. And
I think it's worth noting, too, that during this Washington State legislative session this year, Manuel Ellis's case was cited a lot by legislators who were working on police accountability bills, looking for some way to, you know, how do we hold all police departments accountable for internal investigations, for dealing with complaints, for retraining their officers so that they don't do this kind of stuff. And two, after it became clear that the Pierce County Sheriff's Department wasn't doing a good job investigating, there was a huge outcry, and Governor Inslee stepped in and said that the Washington State Patrol would investigate. So far, the only thing that's come out of that is that three Tacoma police officers, Matthew Collins, Christopher Burbank, and Timothy Rankin, have been charged with criminal charges. But those three police officers, they're still employed at the Tacoma Police Department, and they are on paid administrative leave. So they really have not, as Job said, has not been any outcome, not any justified outcome to this horrible and shocking death. And so, of course, Manuel Ellis's family is still in search of some kind of justice for his death. And that's why they're bringing this civil lawsuit. They're asking the court to, they're asking the court to intervene and to make sure that there is some kind of justice for what happened. They're also, in their lawsuit, they've named other officers, not just of the Tacoma Police Department, but also some Pierce County Sheriff's deputies as well, some who were on site, on the scene at the time and didn't intervene to stop Ellis's death. And I think also, although Ed Troyer's not named in the suit, I think they might also be seeking some major change at the Pierce County Sheriff's Department. So, you know, getting justice for that death has just been very, very difficult. And that's why the lawsuit is necessary now.
Yeah. Well, it appears to be that is the only motivating factor these days in instituting changes beyond the, yeah, the protests.
Yeah. And I would also point out that the police accountability measures in the legislature that Maria was talking about, several of those did pass. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the atmosphere and public sensibility around police accountability clearly shifted after George Floyd's death. And the protests that followed, they were effective. And the mm-hmm. protests in Tacoma around Manuel Ellis' death have also been effective. So that, unfortunately, is how we see change, and how change has to be forced by popular demand.
Well, speaking of a different type of popular demand, let's talk about this week's election-related news.
Yeah, we're going to talk about a couple of different polls in the election news this week. I noticed that Rich Smith, a reporter for The Stranger, wrote this week about another push poll that he took, which was trying to do two things. One, to demonize Nicole Thomas Kennedy in the city attorney's race while making Ann Davison out to be a moderate Democrat, which she is not. And to make it look like Ann Davison has a lot of legal experience, which she does not have. And the other thing that the push poll was trying to do was to say that Nikita Oliver in the council position 9 race is equivalent to Shama Sawant, while trying to make Sarah Nelson, whose first name they misspelled in the poll, into a progressive Democrat, which she is not either. So that was very interesting.
Funny how they target the women of color.
I know. Yeah. Publicola then dug into court records to try and find evidence that Ann Davison has any court experience at all. And what they found is that she has tried 5 cases, none more recent than 2010, so over a decade ago, and 4 of which involved contested wills. Okay, that's the sum total of her court experience. And this is why.
In other words, no criminal experience at all.
Right. And this is why Davison keeps making stupid statements that reveal that her ignorance of what kind of cases are handled in the city's municipal courts. By contrast, Nicole Thomas Kennedy has been a public defender for the last 4 years and has extensive experience in Seattle Municipal Court. So, be wary of those push polls that lie to you, like that one. I understand, Mike, that you took a push poll this week.
Yes, another one.
Yeah. So I had taken several phone polls previously, and this week I got a online survey from what appears to be the same organization because of the wording is so identical to what they'd done previously via the phone, which I think is EMC Research.
Mm-hmm.
What was interesting was I immediately recognized it as being the same place that had polled me twice before, so I kind of had a sense of what to expect in the flow of the questions. And so it became intriguing at one point. It was primarily focused on – it was both the city attorney race was mentioned – and then primarily it focused on the mayoral election and
okay.
the two candidates running, Lorena Gonzalez and Bruce Harrell.
So probably paid for by the PAC that supports Harrell. So what kind of questions did they ask?
Well, in general, it was, again, it was kind of very basic questions. For instance, does this make you more or less likely to vote for a candidate with this attribute? And attribute in this for one was it is supported by labor unions. Okay, that was one of the attributes. Republicans.
Yeah, that's direct reference to Gonzalez.
Or is supported by the business community.
Direct reference to Harrell.
Supports defunding the police by at least 50% and further reducing the number of officers in Seattle.
yeah, it's supposedly a reference to Gonzalez, but not really, because she said she doesn't support a specific number.
Is endorsed by the Seattle Times. Does that?
That would be Harrell.
That would make me less likely to vote for them.
Another one was, is supported by council member Shama Sawant.
Oh, there you go. I don't think Shama's endorsed anybody in the mayoral race.
I don't believe she has. But that's another interesting factor that came up in one of the recent polls was they're asking you about the two candidates, how you feel in general about specific candidates. And originally, a couple weeks ago, it had a fairly long list of different people on city council and involved at the city. And this week, they just brought it down to Bruce Harrell, Lorena Gonzalez, and Shama Sawant.
Yeah, there you go.
Of course.
And she's not running for anything.
I know. Did the questions progress in any kind of direction? Because sometimes they'll start out with fairly neutral questions, and then they really progress to the bad stuff towards the end.
Well, and that's what they've done previously, was they, on one of the mayoral surveys, mm-hmm. they essentially came out with fairly long statements describing the two candidates, and it was pretty damning. I mean, if you didn't know any better, it was pretty damning statements for both candidates, an equal number of statements, and you know, just mm-hmm. to gauge, I think probably you know what will gain traction publicly with people, you know, mm-hmm. in their campaigns. So I was waiting for that on this week's poll. And it never came. It just came for one candidate, strangely enough. And that candidate was, does this make you more or less likely to vote for Lorena Gonzalez? And if you have time, and just stop me when we go too long, because there was quite a few of them. Here we go. Gonzalez pushed for a massive salary cuts targeted at Chief Carmen Best and her leadership team. Chief Best, the city's first African-American police chief, then resigned, saying that the council policy debate had become too personal and was about political grandstanding and power plays. So again, there are a lot of
inaccuracies in that statement.
Exactly.
From the huge salary cut, it was a very kind of nominal salary cut, to the reason for why Best resigned. She didn't resign because it had become quote unquote too personal. She resigned because it was the nominal salary cut would affect how much of a pension she could collect. That was why she resigned.
And she got more out of that pension when she resigned when she did.
Right.
So that's why she resigned at that time.
Right. For her pocketbook is the thing.
All right. So next one, Gonzalez and her activist left supporters are more interested in protecting unsafe and inhumane tent encampments, ignoring misdemeanor crimes, slashing the police budget, and completely eliminating single-family home zoning than they are in listening and responding to the various concerns and fears of Seattle families, neighborhoods, and businesses. Time and again, Gonzalez has shown she can't be trusted to listen to the concerns of people she is supposed to represent.
So that's taking one of the main criticisms against Bruce Harrell, is that he never visits anyone in the neighborhood and doesn't listen to any of their concerns, and it's just pasting it right on top of Gonzalez is what that's doing.
Yeah.
Essentially, it's basically saying, well, the main criticism against Bruce Harrell is that the whole time he was a city council member, and I'm going to talk about this later, the whole time he was a city council member for South Seattle, he never showed his face in the neighborhood, never talked to people, never met with small business leaders, never went to any organizational meetings in South Seattle or political meetings of any kind. He basically didn't care. And it's just taking that and putting that main criticism against Harrell and saying, oh, that's actually an attribute of Lorena Gonzalez, which is absolutely not true.
It also sounds like, and I'll give you some more examples of exactly the voiceover you would hear in a commercial for Bruce Harrell.
Yeah.
So it's great text for people who want to learn how to slam other people, entering the PR world. Okay. Yeah. So here's the next one. Gonzalez was the only council member to vote against a regional approach to homelessness, which she said months earlier was the best way to tackle the issue. Now she lists being a representative on the Regional Homelessness Authority, which she voted against, as one of her signature accomplishments. Gonzalez is a prime example of the council's dysfunction and can't be trusted on homelessness.
Wait, I think I debunked that before. I think she voted against an aspect of it, but didn't vote against it in the final.
Yeah, one of the most common ways to slam an opponent in a political race is to take a procedural vote out of context.
Yeah, and I think that's what they're doing there.
Yeah.
I think I've debunked that before.
I believe you have. Mm-hmm. Next up, as council president, Gonzalez led the charge to cut the police budget by 50% and supported dramatically reducing the number of police officers, even as police response times skyrocket.
I'm just gonna stop you right there, because that statement makes it sound like it was a done deal and that that's what actually happened, when in fact, no, that is not what actually happened.
Not even remotely.
The total cut was 6%. Okay. The total cut was 6%, and officers, there's not an issue with filling vacancies at the police department because of that budget cut. It's because all employers everywhere are having trouble getting enough employees right now, and that includes most police departments in the state of Washington as well as around the country.
And the Seattle Police Department has had shortfalls in recruiting for years and years. This is not something that goes back to last summer and the council's actions.
Yeah. So
let me just finish that one.
Finish that one.
Number of police officers, even as police response times skyrocket. Property crime is rampant, and gun crime and violent crime are at their highest point in a decade. And even after almost 300 police officers have left, Gonzalez says she wants to further defund the police. So
the 300 police officers who've left include a lot of officers who have discipline problems. Okay. That's one of the things I want to point out there. And I think everyone should view that as a good news. Okay. That a lot of the officers with discipline problems have left the department. Okay. And those that don't want to change the culture at the Seattle Police Department to respect the rights of people of color, a lot of those officers are in that 300 who left. That's good news. Okay.
All right.
So I want to point that out right off the bat.
Let me give you some more if you're up for it. Gonzalez says addressing homelessness is a top priority, but her website didn't even mention the word homelessness until the Seattle Times asked her about her lack of a plan. When pressed, Gonzalez said she believes that council's status quo approach is working. If elected, Gonzalez says she will continue this failed approach that has led to unsafe and inhumane tent encampments taking over our parks, sidewalks, and public spaces.
Okay, so two things about that. One is that the reason why the budget that the city council passed is not being enacted is because we have a mayor who won't spend the money on things like tiny home villages that would get people out of tent encampments. And the second thing is that the city signed over their responsibility for their homelessness services to a new regional authority. Mm-hmm. And Gonzalez has said that over and over and over again, that it makes no sense for the mayor to come out with a whole plan to address homelessness when there's a regional authority whose plan is to address homelessness, and that we really can't, as a body that is subject to the regional homelessness authority's plan, we can't come out with our own that does anything really different from that. So she's right in that. And when Bruce Harrell says, oh, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that, he's lying. He's not going to, because of the Regional Homelessness Authority.
Yeah, and I'm not sure that Harrell understands that the circumstances have changed since he was on council.
Yeah, he may not cognitively understand that at the moment.
So I would also point out that this is one of the most common right-wing talking points for anti-homelessness people, or anti-homeless people, is tent encampments are inhumane. But they don't generally propose any other alternatives to it, which means that their idea is we need to sweep homeless encampments.
Jail is their alternative.
Yeah, and just leave people to sleep in doorways or under bridges. are intense, which is far less safe, obviously. So, you know, it's a very disingenuous talking point.
You got time for three more?
Sure, let's do okay. it.
All right.
I'm having a good time. How about you,
Maria? I am,
Maria?
Too.
Feels like a game show.
It does.
In private texts released as part of a lawsuit, Gonzalez shows nothing but contempt for voters. After Seattle voters passed multiple tax increases to address homelessness, including raising their own property taxes, Gonzalez said of those opposed to yet another tax increase, and this is the quote, "It breaks my heart that more homeless people will die before the privileged voter is ready to act. It's nauseating, actually," end quote.
I think she's right. I mean, her proposed tax increase, they're making it sound like she's going to raise property taxes, and she's not. She's talking about a tax on the wealthiest businesses and individuals in the city of Seattle.
Yeah,
and I think there's broad
mention.
Support for that. And by not mentioning that that's what her tax proposal is, I think that's really deeply misleading.
All right. Next up, in 6 years on the council, including the last two as council president, Gonzalez has led the charge to stop cleanup of encampments and says as mayor she will double down on the city's current approach. Meanwhile, homelessness has gotten dramatically worse despite multiple tax increases and record spending. And now, based on that record of failure, Gonzalez wants to be promoted to mayor.
I should also point out, too, that if they should be mentioning what those multiple tax increases are and what they're really for, because it seems to me like there haven't been multiple tax increases to address only homelessness and affordable housing.
I would also point out, and Art, I'm going to say, what is BS for 200? that you know, the city's current approach is centered on the mayor's office, and it's centered on sweeping homelessness encampments. That's the failed approach.
Yeah.
And as Maria said, the mayor refusing to spend money that council allocates for support services. So, you know,
yeah,
when
you had people down at City Hall this week saying, "Hey, Durkin, release the funds. Release the money to build these tiny home villages. Come on, let's do it before the end of the year." And the city has to stop spending altogether on homelessness services,
yeah,
because
and
of the regional authority taking over.
And before the weather turns, which it now has, mm-hmm. And we get into winter.
Yeah. So there are people down at City Hall begging the mayor to release the funds that the city council appropriated. And clearly that's something that these folks who are push-polling want you to not know about.
And the final one was, Gonzalez has said as mayor she will abolish all single-family zoning in Seattle. Gonzalez says she will rezone single-family neighborhoods to allow large multifamily apartment buildings, triplexes, duplexes, and condominiums.
I'm going to say five Pinocchios on that one. There really aren't any elected officials that I'm aware of that have said abolish all single family zoning. That is a boogeyman on the right.
Well, Andrew Grant Houston did in his race, and I believe that there were other folks. He's not an elected official. No, and I believe that there are other folks who were running who said that they would at least look at that, and I think Lorena Gonzalez was one. And I have to say that there are plenty of people, particularly renters in the city, and renters outnumber people who own their homes in the city of Seattle now, who would love to see single family zoning abolished so that there could be more affordable housing constructed in more areas of the city.
That is absolutely true.
Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of homeowners who hate that. And that shows you who the Harrell campaign is really targeting. They're targeting people who are wealthier and who own their own homes in the city of Seattle.
And who like the idea of somebody who's supported by business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So like I say, I had taken two of their polls prior, two of their surveys prior, and I kept like waiting for, okay, well, where's the ones about, you know, Harrell? You know, this is a lot for Lorena Gonzalez. When am I going to get to the Harrell ones? And they just never appeared. So,
yeah. So I also want to say something about those online polls where they just email you the link. those can be gamed so easily. Now, if you want to take a secure online poll, you take one of the polls that the federal government sends to businesses to do like business census surveys. They send you a secure code when you click the link to access the poll. It's a one-time code. You enter it, you take the poll, and you're done. You can't retake it from a different device or something. But these online polls where they just email you a link, you can forward that to your friends so that they can take the poll. You can open an in private browsing window, which will mask the IP address of your computer, and you can retake the poll. You can forward it to an email address on your phone, and you can retake your email account on your phone, and you can retake the poll. There's all kinds of
ways. Or a different device.
Yeah, there's all kinds of ways to game that. And what they really want you to do is they want you to forward it to your friends so that your friends get the push polling message when they take the poll. That's what they want to do. So the results of this poll will never be released. It's really literally a campaign tactic to get negative messaging out about Lorena Gonzalez.
Yeah.
So that's how that push poll is working.
They will actually tally the results, but that's in order to refine their messaging.
Yeah.
So
they'll say, oh, look, everybody hates this, they'll go, oh, look, people really respond to this message. So that's what he should be hammering her on. Mm-hmm. Now, so, I also want to kind of go on and talk this week, too, about the 37th District Democrats had their meeting to endorse candidates. That's the district that extends from Capitol Hill and Pioneer Square downtown through Rainier Valley to Renton. They voted this week to endorse Nicole Thomas Kennedy for Seattle City Attorney with 66.3% of the vote. In Council Position 9 race, they voted no endorsement with 66.2% of the vote. And this is being widely viewed as a big win for Nikita Oliver, who couldn't qualify for their endorsement because she's a member of her own political party, the Seattle People's Party. So she didn't qualify for direct endorsement by the district Democrats like Sarah Nelson did, but they didn't endorse Sarah Nelson. They voted no endorsement. When it came time to vote for a mayoral candidate, again, no endorsement won with 60.7% of the vote. In two earlier rounds of voting, Lorena Gonzalez fell just short of an endorsement, receiving 59.2%, and she really needed a minimum of 60% to win the endorsement. Harrell, who used to represent that part of town when he was on the city council, he never received more than 39% of the vote. So this too can be viewed, I think, as a victory for Gonzalez and a real slap in the face for Bruce Harrell. But then again, a lot of the people who voted for Gonzalez in that endorsement vote said, why would I ever vote for Harrell? He's never shown his face at any of the district Democrat meetings. He's never shown his face at any business community meetings. He's never come out at any public events to shake hands and speak to and listen to people. Why would I vote for someone who's an absentee candidate?
And I would also point out that the reason Harrell is no longer on council, he declined to run for re-election 2 years ago because it was very clear from early polling that Tammy Morales was going to unseat him.
So, district.
Yes, yeah. and she wound up winning that election. But she ran a very strong race against Harrell in 2015. And in 2019, it was very clear that, people in that district were just fed up with Harrell. They were ready for somebody new. So it's not particularly surprising that the LD 37 folks didn't want to endorse Harrell. Why would they endorse him for mayor when they already rejected him for council?
Yeah. Yeah, so that's an interesting thing that happened this week. And then there was the Crosscut Elway poll, Mike, that you took a couple weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
The results of that poll were released this week, and it was widely publicized as a legitimate poll versus a push poll with slanted questions that are meant to test how voters respond to certain types of messaging. And then push voters to think a certain way about specific candidates and issues. A legitimate poll is meant to kind of test what voters are already thinking about and where they're at in terms of the candidates currently. But even legitimate polls that are supposed to reveal how voters are thinking can have biases and problems. And I dug into the details of the Crosscut Elway poll, and it has some big problems that I think are revealing of why a lot of polls these days have not done a good job at forecasting what actually happens on election day. I just kind of want to talk about them a little bit. Part of the problem lies in the number of voters polled. The Crosscut Elway poll only talked to 400 people. That's just 0.8% of the voting population. And you could get away with that if you're very, very careful about making sure that the mix of people you poll accurately represents Seattle voters. But
even with that sample size, it's almost impossible to draw any conclusions from the tabs, from the specific, you know, categories of, say, voter age, income, anything like that, because there's just not enough of a sample
size.
There's
not enough, yeah. But there are even further problems in the demographics of who they polled. For example, 51.5% of the respondents were over the age of 50. In fact, in Washington State's Congressional District 7, which covers about 3/4 of Seattle, people under 50 make up about 60% of registered voters, not 48.5%. So that's a significant problem with the Crosscut Elway poll. And it further breaks down the age ranges. In the Crosscut Elway poll, only 19% of their respondents were under the age of 35, but District 7 voters, people under 35 are 31% of voters. Almost 1/3 of all voters are under 35. And that was, you know, that is a huge difference and a huge shortcoming in a poll like this. People over 50 in the district are only 40% of the registered voters in District 7. And if you look at Congressional District 9, which covers the Southeast Seattle and a large part of Southeast King County, the age range is really pretty similar to District 7. So that's a serious shortcoming with the poll. It skews towards older people. Another problem with the demographics of the poll is that it skews heavily towards homeowners, which make up 60% of its respondents, versus renters, which make up only 40%. Now, folks might remember a couple years ago, 2019 was the first year that renters outnumbered homeowners in Seattle by approximately 4,000 people. Which means the Crosscut Elway poll should have balanced this at least 50-50, if not 51-49 in favor of renters, not 60-40 in favor of homeowners. So that's another serious problem.
And the demographic trends in the recent years have been an increase in the number of renters, decrease in the percentage of homeowners, and so that trend has likely continued over the last 2 years.
Yeah. Now, a third problem lies in the income levels of the respondents. The current median income in Seattle, and median income means half of all Seattleites make more than this number and half of all Seattleites make less, is $102,486.
Man, I've been doing it wrong.
I know. But only 42% of respondents in the poll had income below $100,000 instead of the around 50% that it should be. Okay. 13% of respondents gave no answer at all to the income question, which means they probably, and I'm thinking in terms of some of our clients in the tax firm, they probably didn't answer the question because they're wealthy and they don't want people to know how much they make, which tends to be an attribute of people who are extremely wealthy, right? Furthermore, the number of Seattle residents who make less than $50,000 per year is 26%, but the Crosscut Elway poll, only 16% of respondents fall into that category. So you were starting to see a trend here, heavily weighted to older people who are homeowners who make a lot more than median income, right? Okay, and finally, a fourth problem is the ethnicity of the respondents, 77% of whom are white in the Crosscut Elway poll. In reality, in Seattle, 63% of residents are white. So you could say, well, maybe more white people vote, but I really don't think that's true. Not in an election that features several major candidates of color in nearly every race. I think we're going to see a lot of people of ethnicity, of people who are non-white, who are voting. And in those four ways, the Crosscut Elway poll is highly unrepresentative of Seattle voters. So, of course, it's not surprising.
All of those problems skew toward more conservative voters in general.
Yeah, so it's not surprising to see then that they favor Bruce Harrell over Lorena Gonzalez and Sarah Nelson over Nikita Oliver, and that their biggest concerns are homelessness, crime, and the police, right? But I think what's also really interesting is that the issues that they were able to select from, that's where you start to see the bias of the people who wrote the poll and how they targeted the poll, because respondents could only choose things like homelessness, crime, police department, downtown, parks, opportunities, transportation, and zoning/density. Now, you can argue that those are all issues that wealthier homeowners really care about. And respondents were not able to choose from other choices that people who are renters who make less money might care about, like affordable housing, livable wages, paid time off, daycare and preschool, or the environment, all issues that respondents had to mention on their own under the other category. Okay. So again, even though it's considered a quote unquote legitimate poll, it actually has its biases and it is in a way push polling. Okay. And I think this is maybe a reason why a lot of polls are failing in actually accurately reflecting who is the more popular candidate and what's going to happen on election day, is because they're just not reaching people who are under median income, and they're not reaching people of color, and they're not reaching young voters. And young voters are a higher percentage of the voting population than a lot of these pollsters think. So I think it's really important to understand that when you're seeing big headlines in the Seattle Times saying most people care about homelessness. And that may be true, but homelessness, crime, and the police department are not at the top of the list for a lot of people. And a lot of those people are not in the poll.
Okay. And saying you care about the police department, you know, that can cut either way. It either means that you're concerned about crime or that you're concerned about police abuse.
Yeah, are you concerned about reforming the police department and making sure that the city council and the mayor push harder to institute reform?
All right.
Or in some cases, abolish police, using the police for certain things that they're being used for now.
Yeah. Okay. So we need to move on.
Yeah. The Carpenters Union goes on strike this week.
On Thursday, members of the Northwest Carpenters Union went on strike in Seattle. Other unionized construction workers also stayed away from job sites, choosing not to cross the carpenters' picket lines. The dispute is over pay. An hourly wage for journey-level carpenters is not quite enough to make median income in Seattle if you work full-time or full-time plus. The union leadership had negotiated a deal with general contractors, but the rank and file voted against the contract. The issue wasn't just about pay, though. It was also over pension plan contributions and parking reimbursements. Carpenters would have received $1.50 per hour in parking reimbursement when it can cost $4 per hour to park downtown during a weekday, or up to $24 per day for all-day parking in a garage in the downtown South Lake Union Capitol Hill core. And that's where a lot of the construction is going on right now. And while many carpenters can build a home, they don't make enough pay to actually buy a home in Seattle. And of course, at the same time, rents are going up every year, even during the pandemic. As a renter, I can really testify to that. in response, the Associated General Contractors, the group that represents construction companies, threatened the union with loss of work in Seattle, saying that many companies might decide to build elsewhere if they had to pay too much in wages and benefits to their carpenters in Seattle. I'm pretty sure Vulcan is going to continue to develop its parcels in South Lake Union, and I don't think Google and Amazon are actually leaving Seattle because the general contractors might have to pay carpenters a little bit more in parking reimbursement and wages.
I think they can afford it.
I think they can afford it, yeah. And an interesting political aside to all this, I think one of the reasons why so many real estate developers and construction companies are behind the Recall Sawant campaign is because she's been very vocal in supporting a radical element inside the Carpenters Union, which rejected the contract outright and called for a wildcat strike. So that's kind of a nice thing to know when you're looking at the Recall Sawant campaign and who's contributing to it, that, oh, that's why they hate her, is because she's supporting the unions that work in construction to push for higher wages and better benefits.
All right. And finally, Seattle City Light is being sued.
Yeah, Seattle City Light has for a long time now called itself a green utility. Its Facebook page says that it provides, quote, reliable, renewable, and environmentally responsible power to about 750,000 Seattle area residents, end quote. 80% of their power comes from hydroelectric dams, and City Light uses that as a reason to say that they've been greenhouse gas neutral since 2005, and they claim that they're the greenest public utility in the U.S. Now, the Sauk Seattle tribe is challenging that, filing a lawsuit saying that because Seattle City Light gets 20% of its power from three dams on the Skagit River that prevent the passage of salmon to the upper reaches of the river, that it's not really a green utility. Those three dams are the Gorge Dam, the Diablo Dam, and the Ross Dam, all built in the 1930s. So, of course, they don't include any of the kinds of things that would allow fish passage to the upper reaches. The lawsuit filed in King County Superior Court seeks to stop Seattle City Light from claiming that they use green power, at least until they come up with a way to restore fish passage at those three dams. The Skagit River hosts runs of all five species of Pacific salmon, as well as steelhead and trout. Some of those runs are endangered species now. Fish runs in the Skagit River are much lower now than they were a generation or two ago, and many of the runs rely on hatchery salmon to keep the numbers up. That's not a healthy run. But the Skagit remains one of the best rivers in western Washington for salmon habitat, and it would be a lot healthier without the dams blocking fish passage to the upper reaches of the river, which is typically where salmon spawning habitat is the best. And right now, the Seattle City Light is negotiating a new license with the federal government to continue operating those three dams on the Skagit River. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission could require City Light to improve fish passage around the dams before they allow them to extend their license. And this lawsuit is clearly one way to bring this to their attention. It's also, I think, a way to redefine what renewable green power is. You know, it isn't enough to spill some water over the dam to allow fish to spawn in the lower reaches of a river if you're just barely keeping the fish runs alive, and if you've cut off the best habitat. At the same time, I think it's going to take quite a bit of money to redesign a hydroelectric system to allow fish to swim upstream, and that money may be easier to get from the federal government. This is the first step because, you know, managers at Seattle City Light and Seattle City politicians have really not recognized the urgency of this problem.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's move on to this week's COVID news.
Oh, yeah, there was quite a bit. On Thursday, leaders of King County announced that the county is going to require, effective October 1st, for eating at a restaurant indoors, seeing a movie in a theater, working out in a gym, pretty much any indoor venue will require proof of a COVID vaccination or a negative test recent negative test, and that'll start in October. There's been a lot of pushback to this, as you might expect. and it's not clear how the county expects individual businesses to enforce this mandate, but it will be a mandate, and you will have to have proof of vaccination to pursue most indoor activities in King County. That includes going to clubs and going to sporting events. I should point out also that almost all of the major teams in Seattle in terms of sporting events, that would be the Sounders, the Mariners, the Seahawks, UW football, and the Kraken, the new hockey team, they will all require indoor masking at their events. So King County trying to crack down on this. The number of new cases in King County is somewhat plateaued over the last couple of weeks, but it's not going down very rapidly. We are still in the middle of a pandemic, and this is recognition of that by Seattle King County Public Health. So that's a more than welcome development. Unfortunately, we have not seen any kind of similar action at the state level, at least not yet. Even though Washington State is struggling, and two nearby states are really in crisis. We saw this week in both Alaska and Idaho. In the case of Idaho, the entire state, in the case of Alaska, its largest hospital system adopting crisis standards of care. That's where they will only treat people that they think they can save. If you're too sick and they don't think you're have good odds of surviving, for instance, you've got underlying conditions that make your COVID infection more serious, they will just send you home and try to keep you comfortable. Because they
Idaho is still one of the 19 states in the U.S. that is under 50% vaccinated.
Yeah, it's something like 41%. It's one of the lowest in the country.
Really low. It's one of the lowest.
And the crisis in hospital and bed availability in North Idaho in particular is causing a lot of spillover to Eastern Washington as well. Because, of course, many of those hospitals, if there's no room at the inn, so to speak, in Coeur d'Alene, they're just going to Spokane. So Spokane hospitals are struggling now with bed availability and ICU availability as well. And we're seeing this in a number of different parts of the country, particularly in the Sun Belt, but also, as we saw with Alaska and Idaho, in other parts of the country as well. There's no ICU beds available to speak of right now in Alabama or Mississippi or southern Illinois, which is not getting a lot of attention. We are seeing, hospitals struggling and being overwhelmed also in Florida, Georgia, North Carolina, Louisiana, and Tennessee. So a lot of Sunbelt states with low vaccination rates are getting overwhelmed with COVID. The United States now per capita has the second highest rate of new infections in the world, behind only Mongolia of all countries. Mongolia only has 4 million people. The U.S. has 327 million. So it's a lot more serious in the United States. And we are by far the most new cases and the most deaths in the world. And that is almost entirely a function of the know nothing movement that has stemmed from Trumpism, that is anti-mask, anti-vaccine, et cetera. Today, incidentally, is International Anti-Mask Day. So, that was, declared around the,
Actually anti-anti-mask.
Oh, I'm anti-stupid, which is basically the same thing.
Yeah, can I be anti-anti-mask as well as anti-stupid?
And anti-anti-vaccine. So the rally in D.C., which has gotten a huge amount of media attention and the build-up to it for the last week from national mainstream media, there's maybe a few hundred people there. The number of protesters and the number of counter-protesters, I was watching the live stream all this morning, are about the same. The number of media that are there is about three times the number of protesters. And of course, the number of law enforcement officers is about 10 times the number of media. So it's a total spectacle. you know, you have helicopters overhead and what is a restricted airspace. I mean, it's a total debacle. And the lesson from this is there's nothing like the threat of violence to get the media's attention. When you're talking about protests, because of course we have protests that are larger than this in Seattle all the time, and we can't even get any local media attention for them. So go figure, you know. It's a very discouraging object lesson in what works and what doesn't work.
I agree.
All right. Anything else on COVID?
I should also mention that we have another lawsuit this week. 53 state patrol employees, a dozen Department of Correction workers, and firefighters, healthcare, and ferry system workers have all co-signed. 93 people co-signed on a lawsuit suing Governor Inslee over his vaccine requirement for public employees, which is, I believe, October 18th is the deadline for that. So a significant pushback, and we're hearing a lot, particularly from the law enforcement community, that, well, people are going to quit rather than get a vaccine. And I'm sorry if you are...
I want them to quit.
I do too.
I'm raising my hand here saying one person who wants you to quit if you're not going to get vaccinated.
If you have taken an oath to protect and serve, then part of that is protect, right?
Right.
And you're not protecting the public. You're not even protecting yourself.
Yeah.
So you need to be in a different line of work. I'm sorry, but you do. Mm-hmm. And that might go a long way toward rooting out some of the severe cultural problems in both SPD and King County Sheriff's Office, as well as, you know, Tacoma Police and a number of other agencies.
Are they suing because it's an unfair labor practice because Inslee didn't bargain with the unions before he instituted it? Or are they suing because they think that an employer can't mandate that? Because I think if it's the second reason, they don't have a leg to stand on. If it's the first reason, they might have an issue. But I think a lot of judges would rule that in a public health emergency, you don't bargain that as part of a union contract. That's
saying. It's not the union contract. Okay. Remember the state employees union, which is the largest, you know, public employees union in the state, has already come to terms with the governor's office around this. So they're suing because it impinges on their constitutional right to do something.
To harm other people's health.
Yeah,
because not getting vaccinated or
because
wearing
freedom. I have a constitutional right to shoot somebody. It's basically like that. And it's just as stupid. So I don't think they have much of a leg to stand on in terms of the court system, but, you know, there's a chance they could get a temporary injunction, for example, that would screw things up. There's other ways that this could monkey wrench with the public health emergency. So, that's something to keep an eye on. Let's see, what else?
Thurston County had a record number of COVID-19 deaths this week, with 10 people dying within one 24-hour period at one hospital in Olympia, and that all of those were unvaccinated people. And I think it kind of points out to the unevenness of vaccinations in Washington State. We're seeing a lot of compliance in King County, but then you go outside of the urban areas and not so much.
Yeah, very true. A couple other things nationally. The FDA this week, an advisory panel met to discuss the possibility of booster shots. They voted to approve booster shots for people who are over the age of 60 or who have underlying health conditions, which is pretty similar to what the CDC has already approved. But they voted overwhelmingly, 16-3, not to approve a recommendation for booster shots for everybody, which is something the Biden administration has been saying that they want to implement next week. That's not going to happen next week. It doesn't look like it's going to happen anytime soon. We saw several different studies come out this past week that give very mixed results in terms of the efficacy of booster shots for otherwise healthy people.
I think it's important to note the CDC said when they announced this that their main priority is still for people, everyone to get vaccinated the first time around, that that's going to have a stronger protective effect for public health than people who are already vaccinated getting booster shots.
And
I think
that's really important. Yeah, I would add to that that, you know, people in the rest of the world are looking at this because outside North America and Europe, there's a desperate shortage of vaccines, particularly in Africa and South America. And they're looking at the United States, which we are swimming in vaccines. You can practically go to any gas station and get vaccinated. I mean, we have plenty of vaccine and a large percentage of people who just don't want to get it. And that is what is driving the largest outbreak in the world right now.
Yeah, and I think people in other countries are shaking their head going, what is wrong with Americans?
Yeah, exactly.
It's going to take a long time to explain.
And they've been shaking their heads for the last 5 years, so it's not a surprise, but still.
They've been shaking them a lot longer than that, but it increased more in the last 5 years. Let's squeeze one last item in, if we can, the recall vote in California.
Yeah, Gavin Newsom won handily and very much outperformed a lot of the polling in that race. He got nearly two-thirds of the vote as a no vote for no recall. And part of the problem with this is that there were dozens of other candidates on the ballot to potentially replace him. And the way the recall vote works is if you get less than 50%, then whoever gets the most among all those candidates becomes governor, even if it's only like, you know, 10%. And the choices were a who's who of spectacularly unqualified random individuals. And I think Californians just looked at that and said, you know, Newsom hasn't really done a bad job. Any of these people would do a terrible job. And so they went with Newsom. It was very interesting. I mean, you saw 58% vote no, which is to say supporting Newsom in Orange County. Which was, you know, once anyway, a conservative bastion, but has become much more blue. In Devin Nunes' district, you also saw a majority voting for Newsom. A couple of things to note from this. Number one, the last time California had a recall election when Arnold Schwarzenegger was elected in 2003, that was 18 years ago. And California is much more blue now than it was 18 years ago. And the Republican Party is much more nuts now than it was 18 years ago. Not to say it wasn't nuts 18 years ago, but it's much worse now. So that's one takeaway from this. I think another takeaway is that Newsom ran primarily on being pro-science, pro-vaccine, pro-mask, defending his record in trying to contain the pandemic in California. And a lot of his opponents were running against masks and against vaccines. And you could see where Newsom did most poorly were in the counties with the lowest vaccination rates, which not surprisingly are also the biggest hotspots in California right now. So there's very much a correlation there, and probably also a lesson for national Democrats for 2022 and the congressional races there, because the Republican Party has really become the party of the pro-death party. They're willing to let your kids die. They're willing to let anybody die in order to please one man, Donald Trump. And that is a powerful thing to run on, if California is to be any judge of that. So hopefully Democrats will draw that lesson that, the Republican message is a real vulnerability now. And it's not so much the obstinance in Congress or that they didn't support, the economic relief or the infrastructure bill or whatever. Democrats tend to get bogged down in policy. Just say, Republicans want to kill your kids. And that should be enough, honestly. They want to kill everybody else too. But, you know, and people get very protective about their kids for some peculiar reason.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there, but we'll plan on doing this same time next week.
There will be more next week, I'm sure.
Yes, there will.
The stupid march is on.